Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In studio with me today is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And we're going to be talking about plants, of course, holiday plants. It's not too early for talking about that. And if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also contact us on our Facebook page. Just go to Utah Public Radio in Facebook and you'll be able to post a comment or send us a picture. We've been doing that as well. And then part of our conversation, we'll also look at what to get that special someone, a gardening someone for Christmas or their birthday or whatever the occasion might be. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. So I just barely purchased an amaryllis, the bulb, the size I have never seen before. I can't remember the name. It's a white one.
Oh, yeah.
And
was it a Christmas gift?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help myself. I saw the size of that bulb, and because I wasn't going to get any this year. And I'm like, oh, that's going to have three stalks with 4 to 6 blossoms on each stalk.
Yeah, it's going to probably have four. It'll probably have four stalks. Yeah. So some of the bulbs that we've got in this year are so big, you can't wrap your hands
around
them.
Not on this one.
I mean, they are just massive. And the bigger the bulb, the more flowers you're going to get. So technically, we bring in the two largest size grades of amaryllis bulbs that you can get. And there's not very many places that bring in these larger bulbs. I mean, most of the time you're buying amaryllis bulbs at the grocery store or at Walmart or Home
They come
Depot
in this pretty box.
A cute little box, and, yeah. But they're usually like a 22 to 26 centimeter size bulb. The ones that we bring in, our smallest bulbs are 34 centimeters and our jumbos are over 40 centimeters. So they're almost twice the circumference of the other ones. I mean, they comparatively speaking, you hold one next to the other and you're just like, why would I buy that little?
Well, and if you look at the number of blossoms, a big box store type amaryllis, you're only going to get one, maybe if you're lucky, two stalks out of it.
Yeah.
And
get maybe three or four flowers on each one.
Yeah.
And ours are producing 4 to 6 flowers per stem. And our 34 centimeter bulbs will produce 2 and in many cases 3 flower stems. And our jumbo bulbs, our 40 centimeter ones, will produce 3 and in many cases 4 flower stems. So it's not unusual to get 18 to 24 flowers off of one of those bulbs. And the flowers are bigger too.
So let's talk about, for those that have not grown an amaryllis, it's not that difficult to be able to have the kind of color. Your friends and neighbors will be totally jealous when they walk into the home because it'll be like the focal point of your living room.
Literally, you can walk into our store, pick out the color that you want. We've already got it potted. It already has a season-long fertilizer in with it. It's already been watered. All you have to do is water it maybe once a week for the next couple months and put it in a spot where it gets lots and lots of indirect light, you know, where the sun's not shining right on, but indirect light, and you're going to have an amazing display of flowers, and that's it. I mean, that's all you have to do. Maybe use a stake.
Well, with the one I got, I'm going to have to.
You might have to. If they're getting plenty of light.
I'm going to have to use guy wires once these things come up.
If they're getting plenty of light, they won't be excessively tall. And so if they're getting really tall and they want to flop over, they might not be getting enough light.
So it's like a tomato. If you put it in an area where it's not getting a lot of light, it gets leggy.
It gets leggy, yeah.
Okay.
And so the paper whites and amaryllis are going to do very similar things. But, I mean, literally, you don't have to have a green thumb. You don't even have to be even slightly experienced gardening to be able to grow an amaryllis bulb and have just an amazing display of color during it might be a little late to get them to bloom for the holidays right now, but I mean, they'll be blooming in January when it's cold and wintry and nasty outside, and we're just excited to have something blooming and growing and producing indoors during that season. So they're just amazing.
But you can also get that. Some of them are actually still, they've already started growing. Like I purposely wanted to get this one so I could watch it.
Yeah.
Go myself.
I've got a couple of varieties that are coming along a little early this year. I mean, not early, but just some years, some come on faster than others. It just depends on the harvesting conditions and the growing conditions, you know, in Holland where the bulbs are grown. And so this year I've got a couple of varieties that are coming along fairly quickly, and I've got a few that have good sized flower stems popping up already. And those will definitely be in bloom for the holidays. Some of the other ones are like so dormant that it might be 2 or 3 weeks after you plant them before they do anything. So,
how many years have the Holland growers been cutting back the blossom to keep to get? How many years old is that? The one that I've got.
They're 2 years.
Okay.
They're 2 years old. So they'll start.
Even that big?
Yeah.
It only takes 2 years.
They'll start with a very small piece of the basil root on the plant, about a centimeter cube. And within 2 to 3 years, they can turn it into a 34 or 40 centimeter bulb.
Of course, they're also in optimal growing conditions.
Optimal
and they're
growing
doing
conditions
exactly everything you need to do.
Lots and lots of fertilizer, yeah. And they don't let them bloom for the entire growing period. And so it just saves up all that strength. But I did talk with one of my representatives from the Holland Bulb Growers Association a couple of weeks ago, and he said they've been doing a lot of research with the University of Cornell, with Cornell University, and they've been doing a lot of research on amaryllis bulbs and a lot of other bulbs as well, too. They have kind of an agreement with Cornell. But they have found that if you will take your amaryllis bulb after the dormant season, you know, after you've let it rest for 6 or 8 weeks, or even if you go and you buy a brand new one, if you take it and you soak it in water, I mean, submerge it completely in room temperature water.
The whole thing. So
the whole thing
covered.
For 24 hours before you plant it, it will actually rehydrate up the roots and prepare the bulb for growing much better than if you don't. And so all you have to do is just submerge that bulb in water for 24 hours and then go ahead and plant it after that, and you'll have much, much better results with your flowers than you've had in the past.
Now, I also picked up a bulb, and again, I don't remember the name of it. I just look at the picture on the outside and go, whoa, that looks good. And this is like a double flowering scarlet.
Yeah.
Colored one.
There's one that's like called Red Peacock, and there's Double Dragon. And,
I think it's Double Dragon.
Yeah, there's a couple. The flowers are a little bit smaller, but they're...
And the doubles tend not to get very big.
Yeah, multiple petals. I mean, so you've got multiple layers of petals, and so the flowers look different. They tend to be a little bit smaller, but they're very showy. Yeah, so they're really eye-catching when they bloom, so very, very pretty. I would have to say my favorite new variety over the last couple of years is one that's called Red Pearl. Have you seen the Red Pearl?
I haven't.
It is a dark, dark, deep burgundy red color. And the flowers, the petals are like satiny. They've got kind of
a little shimmer
to it. It's got to be the prettiest one I think I've ever seen.
Must be related to Orange Sovereign.
It is gorgeous. It looks even more... You know how like oriental lilies have that kind of shimmery sheen
like an iridescence
to them?
Almost.
Yeah, when they open up... This is the kind of look that it has, but it's a dark, dark red. Mm. It's so gorgeous. It's really pretty. And we've got, I've got 20, 25 different colors and styles of bulbs.
Yeah, you used to only have one side of the shelf.
Yeah,
now
we've got
to
go on
the
other
side.
Yeah, we got to go on the other side. So there's so many different ones to choose from. If you haven't done an amaryllis for a while, if you come in and look, you'll just be amazed at the colors that are available. And they're just so much fun, easy to grow. They make great gifts. I mean, It's one of the best gifts. Every year, I have people come in the store in January and February, and they're raving about a gift that they were given at the holidays. And 99 times out of 100, it'll be the amaryllis bulb. They make a point of coming in saying, my friend got this for me from you here at the store.
Now I want
and I absolutely love that. It was the best gift. I mean, so most of the time when people are coming in, they're talking about gifts that were given them during the holidays. They're talking about amaryllis bulbs.
So with the amaryllis, what are you seeing as far as the new development of color? We've talked about size.
Yeah.
Some of the looks are a little bit different. Usually they're more like white, pink, red, orange, candy stripes, that sort of thing.
So a lot of stripes and mixtures of different colors. And there's a
green one.
There's a yellow one. Yeah, it's called lemon lime. And it's actually really quite pretty. And it's very, very pretty. Again, a little smaller flower, but very striking color. So the yellow's really quite pretty. You know, purple, magentas, it's not like a deep, true purple, but a magenta color has
come out. I'd have a whole house full of them if they were actually
really
purple.
Pretty, yeah, really pretty. So no blues. I haven't seen anything on the blue side yet, but some of the reds are just so deep and dark, like I said, almost purple colored. They're just some beautiful innovations and colors that they're coming out with. And some of the older varieties that have been around for a long time, they're still amazing as well, too. And Red Lion,
Red Lion.
Orange Sovereign, yeah. I mean, they're great, too.
If you haven't grown an amaryllis before and you don't get it in the pot, maybe somebody's just given it to you and you've just got the bulb.
Yeah.
Why don't you describe what you do to get it ready?
Okay. The 34-centimeter bulbs that we carry are big, and so you have to start with a little bit bigger pot. I always like to use an azalea-type pot instead of a standard pot. And if you don't know the difference, an azalea pot has a wider, flatter bottom. A standard pot is a little more narrow. It's more tapered at the bottom, and so it gives you more stability on the bottom. And I use just an inexpensive 50-cent, 7.5-inch plastic nursery pot, you know, and the azalea pot's inexpensive. And if you're potting it and moving it and you drop it and you break it, you don't worry about it. You know, it's like, I'll take that pot and I'll put it in a nice basket, or I'll put it in a nice ceramic planter or something, so it looks pretty during the winter time. But you're much less likely to damage the pot, you know, during the planting and the moving and, you know, all the stuff that you have to do with the amaryllis bulb. It's just a great way to go. So 7.5-inch azalea pot. I'll usually put a little piece of paper towel or something down the bottom, make sure it's got really good drainage. And so I put that in the bottom to keep the soil from falling out, because these pots have really good drainage holes. And that's essential. You have good drainage. And then the best potting mix you can get. And there's a lot of potting mixes out there. Avoid the ones that have a lot of bark in them. We won't mention any names, but the particular soil that comes in a yellow and green bag is like 50% bark. And it's just, it's pathetic.
It's trash.
It's pathetic. It's great to put out in your garden and work it into your soil as a soil amendment, and that's about the only benefit that it has. It is the worst potting soil I've ever used. Try and stay with something that has virtually no bark in it, and high peat moss, perlite, coconut core, vermiculite, humate. Those are your five key ingredients.
These are essentially a soilless mixture.
It's a soilless mix. There's no garden soil in there. This is a constructed mix, but it has the right amount of water retention capabilities, and it also allows all the excess water to drain out. So if you start with a really good potting mix, then your plant's going to do a lot better. You're going to deal with much fewer insect issues. Fungus gnats are a huge problem if you have a soil with a lot of bark in it, because they like that decomposing material. And so if you stay away from a barky soil, you'll be less likely to get fungus gnats and have problems with the little flies all over the kitchen or whatever. And so great potting soil. Soak that bulb for 24 hours before you plant it. And then try not to damage the root system when you put it in. So I'll put just a couple inches of soil down on the bottom, and I'll position the bulb in the pot with my hand and hold it there so that the roots aren't like getting crushed as I put the soil in. And then I'll use my other hand with a scoop, and I'll gently put the soil in around the bulb, and then use my fingers to kind of tuck it in around the root system so that it doesn't damage those new roots.
What if it's so big you can't pick it up?
Sometimes it's tough. Yeah, sometimes it's tough. But if you're using one of the jumbo bulbs, the 40 centimeters, then I'll go up to an 8 to 8.5-inch pot. And so then you've got room to work around.
So how much room around that bulb should be like an inch
on both sides.
Okay.
Yeah, inch on both sides. And when you're planting the bulb, you really want about half of the bulb exposed. So bury it up halfway and leave the rest of the bulb exposed. You don't want it planted too deep, and you don't want it sitting right on the surface either. So you want to cover it up about a third to half of the way with soil up the sides of the bulb.
So it's okay to have the roots, to set it down into the roots, or just kind of touching the bottom.
Yeah.
But you don't want to put it down any further.
Yeah, yeah. And so the trick is, after you soak it for 24 hours, it's going to rehydrate those roots up, and they're going to be kind of juicy and plump. You know, they're going to look alive. And so if you push it down into the soil, you're going to break all those nice new hydrated roots off. So you just want to be a little careful sticking in the soil.
So when you get it, though, those are usually pretty dry, those roots
there
on the bottom.
They can be kind
of
dry.
Not usually too long, not like if you keep it over.
Yeah, well, think about it. They harvest them in, you know, August and get them all prepped and ready to go and
ship
them out.
But those will rehydrate?
They'll rehydrate, okay. Yeah. They'll actually rehydrate up. And we've done it with onion plants. We've done it with amaryllis. You can do it with paper whites. I mean, you soak them in that water. Those roots just like miraculously just like burst into life and go like crazy. So it's a good way to go. Amaryllis don't need any special pre-cooling preparation or anything. You don't have to stick it in the fridge or keep in a cold spot for any particular amount of time. You can just come in, pick it up, take it home, plant it up, away you go. I mean, there's no waiting. And then the bulbs just kind of come along at their own pace. You know, you want to put them in a warmer location if you want them to come along a little bit quicker, cooler location if you want to slow them down a little bit. But sometimes it takes 2, 3, 4, 6 weeks for them to come out of dormancy, and sometimes they just like spring to life right away. So you got to be a little patient with them. They're kind of like people. Some people move along a little faster than others, and some are a little slower. So
if you wanted to move them along quicker, would you put them in the sun?
Warmer location, not necessarily more sunlight, because we should be giving them lots of light anyway.
Right.
We don't want them like in the direct sunlight. It'll dry things out a little bit quicker, but just a warmer room temperature and they'll come along quite nicely. Every year I've got people that want to do a wedding, you know, and after Christmas, you know, December type wedding, and they want to do amaryllis bulbs for centerpieces. And it's like, yeah, great. You know, let's pick a couple varieties. Let's do twice as many as you think you need.
That'd be fun as a centerpiece.
Oh, that's awesome. But you can't guarantee that yeah. they're all going to bloom yeah. at the same time, you know? And so it's like, let's pick a couple varieties. Let's put them in a nice warm location, try and move them along. If they start coming too quickly, then we'll put them in a cooler spot and slow them down, you know? But sometimes, I mean, it's tricky getting the bloom time to be right. You always want to do extras, but it's a great, it'd be amazing for wedding centerpieces.
And then how often do you fertilize them after you've planted them?
We use...
do you just use something like an Osmocote?
We use a multi-coat type product that's it's like Osmocote, but it breaks down a little bit slower.
Okay.
Doesn't release with temperature. I mean, so it's a 3 to 4 month slow release fertilizer. So you do it once when you plant. And
do you put that in, just sprinkle it with the soil
yeah.
sitting on top
yeah,
or
so,
in the bottom?
So for that 7.5-inch pot, I'll put in like a tablespoon. Yeah, for
just
for
mix
each
it all throughout
and
the soil.
And just kind of sprinkle it on the surface, and every time it waters, okay. it just kind of feeds it a little bit. Then after it's done blooming, then we'll really start a heavier fertilizer regimen at that. And you know, every year it's kind of hard to tell people this, and they look at you kind of funny. But you know, if you want to save money, don't grow the bulb again the next year. Just go buy a new one. I mean, honestly, for the time and the effort and the fertilizer and the water and everything you put into it, it's much less expensive to just go buy a new bulb the next year.
But it's so much
fun. But if you enjoy doing it and it's fun, and I know you enjoy doing it, it's a little bit of a challenge to get it to come back and to bloom and to look good again. I mean,
you'll never look as good as it does
yeah. the first year, unless you just don't let it bloom for a couple of years. But
that's too hard.
Yeah, that's difficult. But if you enjoy the challenge and you love to work with plants and you enjoy doing that, then I will teach you how to get it to come back again. But if you're really just looking to save some money and have a nice show each year out of your amaryllis bulbs, just buy a new one each year. That's just the way it is.
And when you say you do a heavy regimen of fertilization, what does that
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, usually a high phosphorus fertilizer weekly, and we'll grow it inside like a house plant after it's done blooming. So through January, February, March, April, May, weekly high phosphorus fertilizer to get some strength back to the bulb, because you've seen the bulbs after they bloom.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll start at 40 centimeters and you'll be down to like 20 when you're done. I mean,
yeah,
it shrivels the bulb.
The skin
up.
Left behind is shows you how
yeah,
big it was.
Oh, yeah,
and they've
yeah.
gone on a massive
and it just,
diet.
It just uses so much strength to produce all those flowers that the bulb has shrunk in half. And you have to fertilize to get that bulb to get some strength back. And so if you start with a 40-centimeter bulb, fertilize it all winter and then plant it outside during the summer and continue to fertilize it weekly out there, you might be able to get it back to maybe 30 centimeters, you know, where it started at 40 and shrunk down to 20, and maybe get half of it back the first year if you're consistent with the fertilizing. And again, first year, 3 or 4 flower stems, 4 to 6 flowers on each stem, sometimes 8. And the second year, you'll get maybe 1 or 2 with 2 or 3 flowers on it. I mean, it's just not the same.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio with me today. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment or a photo there as well, because we are looking through that. Now, Mark, we've been talking about amaryllis, but what about other bulbs that can be forced indoors. Some of them take a little bit more work.
Yeah.
Let's go from easiest to most difficult. Yeah. So paper whites are just easy.
like amaryllis. I mean, it's stick them in gravel and water. You don't even have to put them in soil. And within 4 weeks, they're blooming on their own. A couple little tricks with the paper whites, though. If you will put a 5% alcohol mixture in with the water, it will stunt their growth, and you won't have them tall and leggy and flopping all over the place. So this is another research that Cornell has done. And you can use rubbing alcohol. You can use Everclear. You can use vodka. You can use whatever you have on hand. Use a 5% alcohol mix with it, and it will keep them short and stocky without damaging their flower production at all.
20 parts water to one part alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I'm not sure if they care for rum or gin or whatever. I mean, I don't think they have a particular
preference.
My
grandma's got a stash of apricot brandy.
And there you go. I probably would not use the good expensive stuff. You know. But that works great. Rubbing alcohol works fine.
But with the paper whites, you can pretty much just stick them in any medium right?
We use a nice decorative gravel because it holds the bulbs, it supports them. The roots can grow down through the gravel and it keeps them from flopping over. So it's a good, inexpensive way to keep the bulbs looking good. We'll keep the water level up about halfway up the bulb throughout the growing season, and the roots will just grow right down into that water, and they grow like crazy. Easier than the amaryllis bulbs.
And do you have to fertilize them?
No.
Because these are definitely ones you don't want to keep.
These are once and done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried keeping them once.
You can't get them to come back.
Work.
No. Even experienced, well-seasoned gardeners can't get them to come back. So this is a once.
Are you saying you failed at
something? Enjoy the show. I didn't even try because like not worth it. Yeah. They are a once and a done. Yeah. They're goners. Our climate is not.
It's just not conducive.
It's not conducive to growing them. No.
But there are now some people have shied away from paper whites because they say, they smell too much.
They have a very strong, sweet smell. And
it's like bringing a whole bunch of lilacs into the home and multiply that a little bit more.
They're intense. But there's a new variety. It's called In Ball that's been out for about 5 years or so. It is much less scented. And it's still scented, but it's probably 30% of the smell that the standard Ziva paper whites are. So it's a really mellowed, toned down scent. But the flowers are gorgeous.
I mean, are they all white?
They're all white, yeah. Okay. They're just kind of a shimmery white, lots and lots of flowers, clusters of flowers. So beautiful. So paper white's super easy. Amaryllis also easy. Been doing a lot of forcing classes. We've been teaching people how to force tulips and hyacinths and daffodils and crocus. The trick with all your spring flowering, fall planted bulbs to get those to bloom inside is to make sure and start with the right bulb in the first place. A lot of times gardeners will get all excited about forcing once they learn how to do it, and they will be unsuccessful. And the first mistake that most people make is they pick the wrong bulbs. If you're doing large, cupped, taller daffodils, they don't force well. If you do large, full cupped, late tulips, they don't force very well either. You've got to stick with varieties that are in the single early category or the triumph category on tulips, because they come along earlier and they just are more prone for forcing.
They're more ready to go.
They're ready to go. Okay. Yeah. And some of these later, taller varieties, they just get leaves and you don't get any flower out of them. You just get nothing. So if you've forced bulbs before and you've been unsuccessful and all you've had is just leaves, it's probably because you picked the wrong bulb to begin with. So look for single earlies and also triumph tulips. Those force very, very well. All your miniature daffodils, all the jonquille daffodils, the miniature ones, they all force great. Hyacinths and crocus, no problem. You can do any of those varieties. But most people are doing tulips, and if you're picking the wrong varieties, they're going to fail just right from the get-go. So start with the proper bulbs. Start with bigger bulbs, the bigger, larger the bulbs. And again, the good soil, like we talked about, just a little while ago.
And would you use the same type of pot again?
Yeah. Use this inexpensive nursery pot. Don't put it in grandma's prized ceramic pot that she left you when she passed away. I mean, because it could get broken in the forcing process. So I'll do them in a cheap, inexpensive plastic pot, and then slide them into a decorative pot later on, so you can enjoy them and have them on the kitchen counter, not be you know, embarrassed when people come over because you got this big plastic, you know, nursery pot sitting there, but you put it in a nice basket or a nice ceramic pot or something. And then after you get it in the soil, you want to plant the bulbs so that the tips of the bulbs are just below the surface of the soil. So you're going to put them just barely below the surface of the soil to force them, not out in the garden. This is forcing them for indoors. Water them thoroughly. The tips may stick out just a little bit, which is fine. If they're sticking out more than, say, a quarter or a half an inch, you maybe want to add a little bit more soil to it so they don't settle too much. But if the bulbs are just barely sticking out, that's okay. If they're just barely covered up, that's great too. I mean, it works fine. Water the soil thoroughly so it's nice and saturated all the way through, and you've got to put it in a cool location between 38 and 50 degrees for 12 to 14 weeks. And that's how the bulbs are going to develop a root system and a flower bud and prepare them to bloom. Basically, what we're doing, forcing them inside, is we're not really forcing them to bloom. We're tricking them into blooming early. And so we're going to fool them into thinking that winter has come and gone. They get that cold preparation, and then we bring them inside to like a cool location in our home for the first week or so. Lots of indirect light, but cooler temperature, 60, 65 degrees, kind of get them used to starting to grow, and then put them in that nice warm location for another week or two, and they'll really take off like crazy. And then as soon as they start to bloom, put them in a cool location where the flowers will last longer. If you put them in a cool spot, you'll get 10 days, maybe 2 weeks out of the flowers. But if they're in a warm, sunny location, they might fade in just a couple days. So once they start to get close to bloom, then you want to move them to a cool location in the house.
So if you do this today, you're looking at February you're going to see.
So if you want to force bulbs for enjoyment in the wintertime, you got to do it in September and October. You got to do it early because you add 12 weeks onto right now.
Yeah,
it's the 1st of February. You might be able to get them to bloom for Valentine's Day if you're lucky at this point. If you want to do them for Valentine's Day, I usually tell people to start them by about the 10th of October, 10th, 15th of October. Mm-hmm. So we're past that. You'd be cutting it really close.
You can still do it.
You can still do it.
And in September, you get more variety to choose from.
Yeah, you get more variety to choose from. And if you start them in late September, early October, you don't have to pull them all out after 12 weeks. And you can let them go 14, 16, 18. You know, so you start them early, and then when they've hit the 12 weeks, then you bring one in, and then you wait a week or two, and you bring another one in, and you wait a week or two, and you bring another one in. You can have flowers going all winter long.
You know, and once they've started growing, the same fertilization regimen.
Yeah. So I kind of do the same thing. I'll put a tablespoon of Osmocote or Multicoat in there. Garden Coat 6 is my favorite because it's got the micronutrients in it. Sprinkle that on the surface. Every time you water it, feeds them. And then the trick with the tulips and daffodils, I mean, all your forced bulbs is after they're done blooming, you want to get them outside and get them planted in the garden as quickly as possible. Otherwise, you might as well just throw them away.
Because they'll just desiccate.
They're just going to desiccate. They're going to be worthless. So as soon as the soil thaws out in the spring, the snow melts, get out there and get them planted in the garden. Let them try and gain a little strength. Leave the tops on. You know, plant them, leave them out there. Leave them as long as you can until the tops all die down on their own. Then cut them down, and they will come back again the next year.
Okay.
But you can't force them again. It won't happen. Just not going to happen. So,
you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is my guest. We're going to listen to the latest edition of Petals and Prose and then be back for the rest of the hour. And we're going to talk about gifts for your special someone, that special someone who likes to garden. So stay tuned.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Global Village Gifts, 69 East, 100 North in Logan, celebrating 10 years with an anniversary nativity night showcasing holiday items from around the world, Friday, November 15th from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Details at globalvillagegifts.org.
Enjoy the beauty and a bit of the history of the Indian corn used in your fall decorations. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Indian corn was originally a food source, not decoration, for Native Americans. It was also grown and used for centuries in China, India, and South America. But before you get ready to cook up this decorative corn, be aware the starchy kernels are not sweet like the corn on the cob we're used to eating. Instead, these kernels are ground into flour, cornmeal, or used for popping. The beautiful multicolored ears of decorative Indian corn is a more recent attribute resulting from more than 50 years of hybridizing. Try growing your own next season. Make sure to keep it separate from edible varieties or stagger harvest times so there's no risk of cross-pollination ruining the flavor of your sweet corn. Allow the husk to dry before harvesting Indian corn used as decoration. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. I'm continuing from last week's Petals and Prose with my essay about Byron Chadwick. And I'm happy to report that the people who now have what was Chadwick's Gardens and is now Willard Bay Gardens are carrying on in the spirit of Mr. Chadwick. Their emphasis is perennial plants, and I know that Mr. Chadwick would be so grateful to them. The woman there is named Della, and she's committed in ways that Mr. Chadwick would approve. So I had called this essay A Perennial Gentleman for a couple of reasons, the primary one being that he was the one place in the state at that time, more than 20 years ago, that specialized in perennial plants. And so I'm continuing to describe this interesting and passionate man and passionate gardener, Byron Chadwick. There aren't many weeds in Mr. Chadwick's gardens, but those intrepid few that venture are easy prey. Mr. Chadwick's weeding is an automatic process, almost as if the hands have minds and eyes of their own. Needing instruction from cerebral cortex centers, but functioning independently, freeing Mr. Chadwick to talk unhaltingly. As we walk through his gardens, this automatic weeding is as involuntary as a mother's wiping of her child's runny nose, or the brushing back of an unruly lock of hair, even while she visits on, unmindful of her hand's actions. One final note on Mr. Chadwick and weeds turns out to be a joke on me. I've had such implicit faith in the weed-free nature of his gardens and the excellence of his plant stock that I have assumed even a volunteer seedling, a stowaway in a purchased flat, must be a plant worth keeping. That happened to me last year. In with status plants I bought, I discovered a strange seedling. I reasoned, though, that it should be kept and nurtured, because it did come from Mr. Chadwick's gardens, after all. When it had grown to my height, shading and crowding out its neighbors, I became a bit worried, though. Too much fertilizer, I thought. At last I called on my friend, a superb plant taxonomist, to identify this rare specimen. When she saw it, she laughed. Oh, that's Isatis tinctoria. With chagrin, I recognized that Dyer's Woad, a brazen, noxious weed so prevalent in the hills around Willard, had even dared to intrude itself into Mr. Chadwick's seedbeds. I strong-armed the vagrant out, but must confess that before relinquishing its long taproot, it threw me on my backside. Fascinated as I have been with Mr. Chadwick's hands, I have listened with comparable fascination to what he has to tell. Certain things have been perennial in his life, like favored plants to be kept. His academic background in chemistry, for instance, undergraduate work at the University of Utah, then graduate studies at the University of Minnesota at St. Paul. Always, though, there was the botany connection. Even his studies in chemistry were directed toward, as a chemist, in the mixing of planting materials. In his work area stands an old hand cement mixer in which he blends planting substances, currently peat, Paxlite, and black soil from the Kaibab forests. Much must have interfered with the completion of his graduate studies. Putting oneself through graduate school has never been easy, but the coming depression must have been formidable indeed, and Byron Chadwick had his young wife, Emily Silver, to think about. German language requirements seemed diversionary and bothersome, having little he could see to do with either of his chosen pursuits. It is not my purpose to delve into the reasons he left Minnesota to go to work at Storrs and Harrison Nursery in Painesville, Ohio. I can well imagine, though, that some might call it karma. At any rate, at Storrs and Harrison, the young Chadwick must have shown himself to be bright and interested and capable. Working with experienced gardeners there from Hungary and Italy, he was given the title Head of Perennials, no small honor for a young person in such company. During the Depression, Byron left Storrs and Harrison, probably with some reluctance, to work for Diamond Shamrock, at that time called Diamond Alkali. He worked there for about 17 years, not entirely satisfied with his assignment, which was neither sufficiently chemical nor botanical, as he would have liked. Neither love was put to rest in those years, though. In his backyard, he experimented with growing plants in concrete frames, an early trial of the hydroponic methods now used so extensively for grocery store variety tomatoes. And he honed his chemistry skills by teaching night classes in the subject. All this while, according to his daughter Nancy, he had the dream of having his own nursery. She grew from infancy to the teen years during those Ohio years, walking with him in the woods and glens, undoubtedly hearing his dreams and listening to his botanizing along the way. Finally, at the end of World War II, he was able to quit Diamond, returning in 1946 to Utah to realize his dream. For 9 months, he worked at a lumber yard, partly as a stopgap measure, partly, I gather, to pick up carpentry skills he needed to build greenhouses. Byron Chadwick's passion for producing beauty from soil, his own and others, has given his life direction, has affected the course of his own life and that of his family. But even such single-minded pursuit must interact with all the banalities and paradoxes and intrusions that life imposes. There are curious and fascinating ironies I have only glimpsed, facets of his life I would love to explore and chronicle. Mainly, though, I sort through facts, coming back always, as he does, to the lore of gardening. I love to contemplate the millions of seed he must have ordered through the years. No plants are shipped in. All are grown from seed on the premises. I've done my share of catalog gazing, so I have no trouble imagining him, long before the snow has left the ground, poring over perennial sections of favorite catalogs. He has generously shared with me names and addresses of some of his favorite suppliers. Now, I will be, come February and March, thumbing through enticing pages from Thompson and Morgan, Gurney, Harris Moran, Bluestone, Ohio perennials, assuming that he'll be doing the same. Gertrude Jekyll, that great English garden planner, gave up painting when her eyesight became poor. In a sense, though, she merely shifted to a larger canvas. Her artist's eye visualizing color and composition in the gardens she created as much as she had done for painting. So too with Mr. Chadwick's aesthetic vision. There is nothing haphazard in his use of plants. With sheer artistry and good hard work, he plants in the total picture. It was not surprising to me, therefore, to discover that his daughter is an artist. She comes by the talent naturally. Continuing the painting garden analogy, I think of this major rock garden as an astonishingly detailed and large mural, like a Monet painting, that encircles a whole large gallery room. So the main rock garden encircles the buildings and indeed outlines the mountain's curve. Hand-gathered stones define beds and borders, wall back mountain erosion, and direct the pebbled paths. Color and texture of flower and leaf are translated here by the vision and technique of a painter. Smaller garden areas reflect not only his artistic side, but also his scientific bent for experimentation. There is a shade garden with his astilbe, ferns, hosta, and bleeding hearts. The cactus and succulent garden could be called a miniature, having no gigantic cacti, but rather diminutive and curious desert plants such as living stones. Those vegetative camouflage experts. In the making of a native plant garden area, in which he hopes to cultivate along with the indigenous sage, and I hope not the invasive woad, the state flower Calochortus natalii, the sego lily, which has ironically reached endangered status in Utah. In his vegetable garden, he loves to try new varieties of peppers and tomatoes and squash. mainly, I suspect, so that he can give them to friends and customers. I began with what seemed to me an ironic juxtaposition. I'll conclude with several more ironies that, for me, in their very incongruity, highlight a man who, unlike many of his fellows, lives in harmony with sun and soil, in harmony with others and with himself. There was the robbery, for instance. A thief, I'm told, knocked down the girl at the register, taking well over $1,000. Mr. Chadwick dismisses all but the affront to the girl, saying, "Oh, well, I sleep better at night than he does." I think of Universal Studios descending on location to make a movie of the Dumar Hughes affair. For a man who has trouble charging for the plants he grows, for a businessman who doesn't advertise or run specials or seek publicity, isn't this another of life's twisted jokes? When Byron speaks of his wife Emily, who died 12 years ago, I sense in him a great love and a great loneliness. And her written comments about him, graciously shared with me by their daughter, confirm the gentleness and sensitivity I've so wanted to convey. Quote, "He likes to walk over the hills, interpreting stories told by the rocks, the flowers, the trees, the wildlife, and the clouds. He is quiet, unassuming, almost self-effacing, uncomplaining, and friendly. In disposition, he is kind. He likes clean, uncluttered space and likes to escape from an obstructed view of the landscape. He feels the pull of any place that is uncrowded and uncluttered with people. Yet he has given me freely of his time. I am told that he befriended Melvin Dumar's lonely son, and he grows plants that attract people to his little green haven like bees to pollen. Perhaps that is the final and the sweetest irony." Again, this is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Welcome back, and we have about 10 minutes left, and we're going to talk about gifts, and we've had a great conversation about to get your special gardening someone.
I thought we had a great conversation for the first segment.
Well, we did.
I mean,
this
that was
is,
like,
this
about,
got even better.
Thinking about bulbs
and
amaryllis, I was just like, I don't think we could have covered anything else. I mean, we kind of hit it all, and so I was like, man, that was really good, Brian. Good job.
So here we have these gifts. So we talked about amaryllis. That's so easy to get for someone, and they'll actually love it.
Yeah. That's got to be one of my favorite gifts. You
know, and that's even for a non-gardener.
For
you're gonna
a non-gardener, you know, you can do poinsettias, but they're really a little bit more temperamental and not as, you know, they take a little extra attention.
And that is one I will not carry over to the next year.
That's just not,
I tried that. I did get it to blossom again, but what the work.
That's a lot
that
of work.
Was,
yeah. If you live in Mexico, you just take it and plant it outside and it just grow.
I got tired of covering it up, putting it in the closet, bringing it out every day.
But we've put together a really nice list of kind of gardening type gifts for either a new gardener or maybe even an experienced gardener that, we talked about it in the break. It's gardening's kind of a personal thing. That's hard to get gifts for gardeners sometimes because I know Brian has his favorite tools and I have my favorite tools and you kind of get in a groove and you stick with those.
I feel really bad. My neighbor gave me a hand tool for Christmas about 7-8 years ago. I've never used it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a white elephant gift. I should take it to a party or something.
Yeah.
Someone else will probably appreciate it.
That would be a really nice white elephant gift.
Okay, so here, domes. You've got a dome.
Oh, this is one of my favorite new products that came out last year, and it's called a Nano Dome. The Nano Dome is a little kit that has a little bit of fertilizer in with it, but it has a flat tray in the bottom. It's a 10 by 20 inch flat that you would grow seedlings in. And then it has a 12 inch dome, clear plastic, heavy duty. Both of these are heavier duty than your standard ones that you would, like if you went to a nursery and bought a flat of petunias and you had the tray with it, it's kind of flimsy and thin plastic. This is a heavy duty reusable tray and the dome will last for many, many years, and it's vented and you can also put a light fixture in it, and the light fixture comes in the Nano kit. The Nano Dome kits, you have a full spectrum bulb that has a 6,400 Kelvin wavelength, which is perfect. It's optimal for growing plants inside there. And so the light fits into this little notch in the dome. And so it encompasses the entire area inside there. I mean, so it's like having your own miniature sun inside the greenhouse, and it provides the full wavelengths of light that the plants need at the right temperature, at the right Kelvin temperature. And I've never grown seedlings ever in a kit like this one. I mean, they're stocky, they're sturdy, they don't stretch, they don't get all leggy and difficult to grow. It holds the right amount of moisture, it holds the right amount of heat. The light bulb generates a little bit of heat, so it keeps things a little bit warmer in there. And we've done microgreens, we've done seedlings, we've done herbs through the entire winter in these Nano Domes, and they just grow amazing.
And you just clip them back and they keep,
coming out. All you need is a space that's 10 inches wide and 20 inches long, and it will fit right there. Doesn't have to be in a window. It could be in a closet. It could be on the shelf in the pantry. I mean, wherever you have a power source, you can just plug it in, set it on a timer, have it go on for 14 hours a day, and you know, off for 10 or six, on for 16 and off for 8. I mean, whatever. And the microgreens, if you've never done microgreens, they are so fun and so easy, and they taste amazing. So you can do like miniature lettuces and spinaches and herbs, you know, basils. I mean, micro basils, just
grow them all together.
The flavor is just so intense. You can do like little patches of it. Mm-hmm. If you want to do some different herbs, you can. We did like full flats of lettuce greens, just a mixed lettuce green. We threw a little bit of arugula and a little bit of mizuna, you know, some other different greens in there with it.
So like a mesclun mix.
Yeah, kind of a mesclun mix. And you can, you know, cut it off for meals, and within 10 days to 2 weeks, it'll grow right back again. So you can use half of it, and they're awesome. They're just a lot of fun.
And so what are you looking at cost-wise?
Nanodomes are about $45, but a light fixture that size is about $45.
Yeah.
I mean, for a good light fixture. So this, the cool thing about the nanodomes is it's not just a full-spectrum light bulb, but it has a reflector that goes along with it. And the reflector doesn't just reflect light. It actually refracts the light. So it splits the light up. So it actually amplifies the light that it's producing. So it's not just reflecting one ray of light back down in the direction you want it. It actually splits it and magnifies it. And so that's why the systems work so well, because there's so much light available to the plants in there.
Okay, Nanodome, N-A-N-O?
N-A-N-O.
Okay.
Yep, because it's got nanotechnology in it that refracts the light.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, very cool. Very cool stuff.
Pruners and hand tools. Yeah. You can't go wrong with a really good pruner.
Really good pruner. I've got a pruner that is a relatively expensive one. It's got a rotating handle on it. It's made by Baco. I've had that for probably close to 10 years now. And I just have a little sharpener in my back pocket and just sharpen it up. And it's just amazing.
Well, and it's worth, in my experience, it's worth having that spent a little bit extra to get the really good pruner. Heavy. Because your hands they're not as sore afterward.
The new pruners are so much more ergonomical now. It's just so much easier on your hand. If you've never used a rotating handle, you got to try one. It takes a little bit of getting used to, but once you get used to it, it just rolls with your fingers, and you just don't have the stress on your joints and on your hand. I can prune 300 roses in an afternoon with it and not even get tired.
Do you have 300 roses?
When the 1,000 roses come in the springtime, that have to be pruned.
Oh, gotcha. At the store.
At the store.
Okay.
Yes, I do. I have pruned 1,000 roses in 2 days before with that hand pruner, and not had to cry waking up the next morning. My hand was tired, but it wasn't like hurting like it could have if I'd used a regular pruner.
So a good pruner.
Yep.
I also think that a good hand saw, not the regular.
Yeah, like either a small folding saw.
A folding saw.
Yeah, when you can get into smaller areas.
Oh my gosh,
it's really nice to have.
I use mine all the time.
Really nice to have. You know, Corona makes good tools, but we carry Baco, and there's just no comparison. The Baco are amazing. I did a little video on our webpage last year with a Baco pruner and a Corona pruner and a Felco pruner. The Felcos are the really expensive aluminum ones from Switzerland. And we were cutting a half-inch ash dowel with it. And I couldn't even cut it with two hands with one of the Corona ones. And with the Felco one, I could do it with one hand, but I really had to just bear down on it. And with the Baco one, I just went and just cut right through like it was nothing.
And so for either one of these things, you're looking at cost-wise about the same?
Coronas are going to run anywhere between $20 and $40 for a good pruner. The Baco are going to be from about $40, maybe even like $30 to $70 for some of the really high-end, you know, rotating handle ones. And the Felcos are even more expensive.
And I've had one for 15 years, It used to be Sandvik, but now is that the Baco?
Sandvik was kind of incorporated into Baco, and they're part of Snap-on tools.
So I've had it for 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's still...
If you're a mechanic, you're familiar with Snap-on, and you know, and they make amazing, amazing tools. So those would be good.
Okay, so just a couple minutes left. So gloves.
Yeah.
Usually can't go wrong with gloves, although you got to get the right size.
A lot of great gardening apparel, hats, gloves, shoes, you know, gardening shoes. We have a lot of different ones to choose from. There's a lot of great choices there.
Hats or shoes?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the shoes.
Yeah,
you can get to.
So we carry Sloggers, and they're kind of like Crocs, but they're a little heavier duty. They're made for outdoors, and they do sizes for both men and women. You know, and a lot of different styles and colors. There's some really nice boots available as well too. So a lot of good options for a gardener.
You mentioned some boots are going to be like $100.
The muck boots. Yeah, I don't carry the muck boots, but we've looked at them. But they're kind of expensive, but they're really really nice. And you can definitely order those online. But they're definitely pricey, $100 to $150 for the muck boots.
What about a wheelbarrow? So I'm in the market
in
for a wheelbarrow.
For a nice wheelbarrow
gift. Okay,
so we've got like higher end type gifts. Fountains. We didn't even talk about fountains. That'd be a really nice one. Wheelbarrows.
So when you're looking for a wheelbarrow, what? I'm always of the idea I'm going to get something that's better quality because I want it to last.
It's going
to
last. Yeah. So you're looking for one with a heavier duty tire and more bearings, so it can handle the load without doing damage to the axle. And you can get even flat free tires now, which are really, really nice, but it adds about $15 to the wheelbarrow. You want a folded steel bin, you know, usually 5 or 6 cubic feet, and those will last for 15 to 20 years easy. And then hickory handles instead of ash handles. So if you're looking at wheelbarrows and they all look the same, you can't figure out why one's $50 and one's $90. It's because the $90 one has hickory handles instead of ash. It's got a heavier duty steel. It's got the high quality bearings, and it probably has a flat free tire.
And it's well worth it.
And it's worth it. It's worth every penny.
And the last item here in the last 15 seconds, a shovel.
Yeah.
Forged head.
There's no comparison. The shovels are built nowadays to be disposable. You buy one, and after a year or two, you throw it away, and you get a new one. If you buy a forged one, it will last you your whole life, and you'll have to replace the handle a couple times. And I've got some old-timers that come in the store, and they bring in, you know, their head, and they want to get a new handle for it, and it's, like, been worn down 3 or 4 inches.
But it's still
good. But they've had it for, like, 40 years. Yeah, and it's just a good shovel. They are heavier, though. It's not one you want to give to your grandma. Definitely a heavier tool, especially if it's full of dirt. But it will last and last and last.
Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden has been my guest. Stay tuned next week for another edition of The Zesty Garden.